Translation: the mothers, after embracing their son, sat him on their laps. Due to pure affection, milk sprang from their breasts. They were overwhelmed with delight, and the tears from their eyes wetted the Lord. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. When Lord Krishna was at Vrindavan, even the cows would become moistened by affection towards him, and he would draw milk from the nipples of every affectionate living being. So what to speak of the stepmothers who were already as good as his own mother? Hare Krishna. So we're reading today about how Lord Krishna is received by his mothers. And Devaki and his other 17 stepmothers. Last week we heard about how Nanda Maharaj had his own house in Dwarka, that where he resided with his 18 wives, and how Krishna. So, page 44, we're on text 29. So last week we heard how Krishna set a great example of how to properly respect one's mother. And he respected all the mothers, not just Devaki, but all his stepmothers also. And they were reciprocated with great affection. Today we're reading how they reciprocated with great affection with him. And it's described here, and there are many descriptions in Srimad Bhagavatam of how Krishna would inspire motherly affection and the women's breasts, and even the cows also, the udders would fill and discharge milk, even if they were older women who didn't have any babies. But Krishna could inspire that emotional response of lactation in motherly affection. And also the crying is described, how the tears of ecstasy were being shed, tears of delight that were actually bathing Krishna when he came back to Dwarka after being in Hastinapur. And so this is this very natural, well, it's more than natural, supernatural, showing the love. But the way the love people have for Krishna, it's the love we have in the material world is a reflection of this transcendental love of Krishna. And the emotions we have in the material world, the different rasas that we have in the material world, are reflections of the pure emotions that are going on in the pastimes of Krishna. In the spiritual world, and then when he brings his pastimes to in his avatar, and he brings all of his entourage to this world, he displays them for everybody, and we can hear about them being described by Shukadev Goswami. So this is a very proper part of culture, that a son must properly respect his mother and father. And this kind of filial duty is there as part of being a decent human being, a righteous human being. Even in the Judeo-Christian tradition, they say it's one of the Ten Commandments to worship your mother and father, honor and obey them. I guess they usually translate honor thy mother and father, but honor is showed by acts of, you know, overt acts of respect. And in this case, Krishna came and bowed down at their feet and put his head at the feet of his mothers, and then they embraced him and sat him on their laps. He was a grown man, actually, but the mothers were passing him around, having him sit on their laps. And so this Krishna, when he comes to earth, sometimes he does wonderful things that nobody can imitate in order to display his supremacy or to teach particular lessons. Other times he does things to set a very good example of a righteous person so that others should follow. He explains that in Bhagavad Gita, that although he really has no duty to perform, it's not like he has anybody to respect. In fact, he is the mother of everyone. He is he's the father as well, and the grandsire. So he's the mother of everyone. He's the source of all everyone. The source of all mothers. Nobody really is his mother, but yet, in his exchange of love with devotees, he accepts some devotees as his mother, and they exchange this kind of rasa with him, and their breasts overflow with milk, and they bathe him in their tears of delight on being reunited with him in this way, this special kind of love that he has. When the Pandavas were traveling incognito to fulfill the gambling match, they had to go in exile, and then the last year they had to be undetected. And so they were posing as different servants in the kitchen. Bhima was working in the kitchen. Nakul and Sahadev were working and taking care of the animals, doing different things. But the people could see, so they were posing as lower class people, but the people could see how they were treating their mother so nicely, how they were treating Queen Kunti. So they knew that they're actually exalted personalities, because everyone must treat their mother very nicely. Mother and father. Father is spiritual master, we read in last week's verse.
Anniversaries and things, that's just once a year. But are there any other recommendations in Shastra about remembering one's parents or things like that?
Because there are in Shastra there are performances of offerings to the forefathers. And in fact, the word putra, which means son, actually breaks down to that one who delivers you from put. The father is delivered by the son because of the son's performance or observance of these rituals. Sure, the Prabhupada didn't teach us these rituals to observe. They're in the one sense, they're not necessary for pure devotees to observe. Most of us actually, with the Westerners who joined the movement, our parents didn't want us to become Hare Krishna devotees. They wanted us to, take over the family business or become doctors or lawyers or be respectable. My wife Jagarini, she's doing Facebook these days, and her Facebook name is Jagarini. So when you have your name, then whenever somebody tags you in a photo or something like that, regardless of how it was originally written, it will put your name, your Facebook name. So she had some photos from her niece's graduation when she was up in New York, and she had put her other name, but somehow it changed to Jagarini. And her mother called up all upset, "Well, I don't want to be associated with that Krishna stuff." Why? Jagarini was saying that actually her mother was saying the name of Krishna so many times. Why do you? I don't mind if you do that Krishna in your life, but you have to bring all that Krishna, Her mother doesn't really use Facebook, so she didn't know exactly what happened. But she had been told by one of Jagarini's cousins that your daughter is using her Krishna name in the family photos, or something like that. And her mother called up to complain. We normally, a good son, good child will obey the wishes of the parents. And the parents want the children to do so many things, and the children have an obligation to make the parents happy, and then even to fulfill the parents' memory, to honor the memory of their parents, they will try to carry out the wishes of their parents. If they know that their parents wanted them to do some particular thing, and they'll carry that out. Of course, the best thing one can do for one's parents, speaking of delivering the parents from hell, the putra idea of offering, even when you offer pinda, what you do is you make an offering to Lord Vishnu, and then the Mahaprasadam is distributed to the ancestors, so that in whatever condition, wherever they are in Pitri Loka, they can take the benefit of doing devotional service and honoring prasadam, and then they're able to live nicely in the planet of the ancestors, and not have to suffer from a hellish condition for the sins that they performed in their lives or something. But the best thing one can do, we were just reading in the story of Prahlad Maharaj, how he was concerned about his father. He was asked to take a boon, and he didn't want to take anything for himself. But then he said, my poor father, he's opposed to you. I want him to be relieved. And Lord Nrisimhadev says, you don't have to worry about that. Just because you're his son and you're a pure devotee, 21 generations before and after you have become immediately liberated by virtue of their association with you in their family. So the best thing we can do for our ancestors is to chant the holy names very nicely, without offense, and to become first-class devotees. And the more, whatever devotional service that we do, it's good for those around us. It's good for those in our, whatever country we're in, whatever village we're in, whatever, group of people we're associated with, and it's good for our families. So the best thing to do is become pure devotees, and we don't have to do. If you have some family tradition where you do some Vedic tradition of worshipping the ancestors, I know even in other cultures, sometimes I see people from East Asia, Chinese people, Japanese people, Southeast Asian, Thai people, Burmese people, they'll have, if you go to the restaurant, there'll be a little shrine and there'll be pictures of their parents and little fruit and incense is offered every day, or water. And Memorial Day is for those who've fallen in combat. Now, I always get mixed up Veterans Day and Memorial Day. One of them was from Civil War time. And I think Memorial Day, although it may have been older, it's after World War I they started having poppies, because in the fields of Europe, in France and Belgium, there are a lot of these beautiful wild flowers, red poppies. In French they call it coquerico. And in Memorial Day they distribute these little poppies to remind us of the people who, the Americans who were fighting in World War I and died and are buried in the fields of Flanders, in Belgium, where in order to invade France, the Germans had to come through Belgium, and there were some battles there. Yeah. But I never remember which one, Veterans Day and Memorial Day, which one came first, and one of them came after. One of them came after Civil War, and then there's a meaning, like one of them is to remember those Americans who died in combat serving their country in uniform, and then the other one is to remember all those who've been suffered in war, whether on the enemy side or whichever side. And there's some more but I don't know that.
Arrow may still be living. That's the Veterans Day. Uh-huh. It honors all who participated in war.
Okay.
Whether alive or dead.
Uh-huh.
Memorial Day honors those who died, gave their lives in war.
Okay. So for those who didn't hear, because there was no microphone, the Veterans Day is for all of those who served in the armed forces, whether alive or dead, and Memorial Day is for those who gave their lives in war. Okay.
Yeah. That kind of makes sense, because I get letters asking to donate for veterans. So they must be alive.
We have a tradition started, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago in ISKCON, in California anyway, that Memorial Day they have a festival in Los Angeles to remember Srila Prabhupada. And so they have a Prabhupada festival. Did you have a...
My question was about Pitralok.
Uh-huh.
So in that planet, what are our ancestors doing there in the Pitralok? Like, why are they there? They have not taken a birth?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. It's a little confusing to me, but I think it's something a little inconceivable. I know that in the 10th chapter, Krishna is talking about, you know, who he is of the different things, and of the Pitris, he's Aryama. And so Aryama must be like the king of Pitriloka or something like that. I haven't read any description. Probably some of you know better than I do. I always assumed that, you know, there's like a kingdom there and people are living there and what they're doing. But how are they there? And then they've also taken birth somewhere else. You know, some things are a little inconceivable.
Forefathers qualified to go back to Godhead. Why is it that they are not there and they are in Pitraloka? That question also comes up.
Yeah.
Unless that was the stage that they would go through before going back to Godhead, but that would be speculation.
Yeah, if they went back to Godhead, then they're probably not in Pitraloka, unless they went there to bless Pitraloka with their to go on book distribution there, door to door in Pitraloka. You know, there must be apartment complexes in Pitraloka too. No, I'm just. But the animals are someone's ancestors.
So my question was, how do we define an ancestor? Is it just the human beings who have ancestors, or like, what if a human being becomes a dog in the next life?
Yeah, my understanding is that. That, you know, when we talk about the Pitris, that, you know, each person is respecting, the humans are respecting those who are their father, mother, the grandparents, the great-grandparents, in other words, those who are, you know, bodily relatives to their body. We even say that in law. We say, you know, I bequeath, you know, this property in fee simple to the heirs of my body. You know, which is, you know, an old English law way of saying to those people who are my progeny, according to the laws of succession or whatever. But it's all a bodily relation. And that may be why Srila Prabhupada doesn't talk too much about it, and why the Srimad Bhagavatam doesn't discuss too much, that it's really more on the level for people who are, you know, it's not in the realm of pure devotional service. It's more in the karmakanda level of people who are, you know, concerned about bodily relations more. But that doesn't mean it isn't real. Krishna refers to it in Bhagavad Gita that Aryama of the Pitris, he's Aryama. There's a planet where the ancestors go and we could worship the ancestors in a certain way. And at the same time, they may already have taken birth somewhere. You know, there is some amount of time usually between the time that you leave your body and the time that you go to Yamaloka, Yamaraj, and he puts you in a new situation.
I heard that Pitraloka is like the living entities over there. They do the service of, you know, whatever Pindadan and all this thing happens. I mean, whenever offering is made to the forefathers, they are taking that offering and wherever that soul is now, and they are going and delivering it. So that is their, that is their work.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how I have heard from devotee that they are doing that work. That whenever, you know, somebody is offering something to the forefather, that offering, that punya, that pious activity, that pious credit, one has to go and give it.
Mm-hmm.
The soul, wherever he is now.
Even if he's body. In some other
yes,
family,
yes,
other
yes,
planet. Other.
Yes, yes. So they do that thing. And they have these mystic powers in them, by which they become smallest of the smallest, and they sit on the ray of the sun, and they travel and they find out where that soul is, and they give him the task. So this is, I have heard, but But yeah.
But who is that they?
Who are
they? The Pitris.
Who are delivering this? Who's the they?
They are not the forefathers, but they are those who are.
Some messengers.
Yes. They are not the forefathers.
Like some demigods or something, some
yes.
kind of, you know.
I mean, like Yamdutas, so they are that kind of Dutas
uh-huh.
who do this activity that whenever credit has been offered, they'll sit and they'll go and they'll find out where that living entity is and they give it to him.
We always hear that there's 33 million demigods.
Yeah,
I don't know if they're demigods, but I'm thinking, who are all these, you know, everybody hears about Varuna and Chandra and, you know, the same 20 or so. What are all the other millions, you know? And I don't know if, you know, we know that there are planets, there are planets of sages, you know, above the demigods' planets, there are the Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka. And then there are, you know, Gandharvas, and like in the 10th chapter, Krishna's saying of the Yakshas and so forth, I'm, you know, Kuvera, and of the, you know, so there are planets where there's Rakshasas and Yakshas, and there's and Nagas and you know, and also there's Pitriloka and who's there. I always had the impression that the ancestors were also there, but there's also messengers there. When Lord Chaitanya became, you know, started to display his mood of devotional service was after his father had passed. And he went to Gaya to do to offer pinda. And, you know, as a tradition to go there, and from Navadvip you could walk to Bihar where there's temples, a lot of temples of Vishnu are there. And he went there and met Ishwarapuri. He stayed for 8 or 10 days or something like that, 8 days. And he had this, you know, he saw the Brahmins there chanting, and he had disciples because he was a teacher, you know, he was a brilliant grammar teacher, logician. He had defeated Keshava Kashmiri, and he had people traveling with him. I think that he got a headache or some kind of difficulty, sickness. And the only thing that would cure him was that he would take the water from the dust of, from the feet of brahmanas, you know, so he showed how much he respected brahmanas, that the only thing. But then, anyway, he met Sri Ishwarapuri and got initiated into a 10-syllable mantra, and he stayed there. And when he came back, he was just thinking of the bells ringing in the temples and the brahmanas chanting and the big temples of Vishnu. And he was his eyes were constantly filled with tears. And when he came back to Navadvip, these Vaishnavas who were there, Advaita Acharya, Ishwar, Srivas Thakur, and others, they knew about Nimai Pandit because he was one of the young, you know, famous young teachers and scholars in town. But now they've heard, oh, have you heard? Nimai Pandit has come back, he's become a Vaishnava. And not just an ordinary Vaishnava, but his eyes are always filled with tears and his body is always being swayed by these ecstatic devotional emotions. And they all came to see him and stuff. But anyway, that was his pastime that he began to display his devotional sentiments after going up to memorialize his father's, you know, to offer pinda for his father's having passed.
Even Prabhupada didn't teach after what is the pitru, that pinda or Pitrudarpan. So what is the tradition after he passed away? What from his children or his family or the organization to do anything, any kind of Pitrubali?
Well, when we celebrate the disappearance day of Srila Prabhupada, of course, You know, when a transcendental personality passes away, you know, we say that they never die, right? They're just like avatars. You know, they like the sun. When it sets or before it's born, it still exists. You know, it's just we don't see it. And when Srila Prabhupada's disappearance day, the devotees, you know, gather and make offerings to him. You know, similar to his appearance day, but with a, you know, usually a more of a somber mood of you know, there's a kind of ecstatic mood of when, you know, of thinking how can we go on without his presence. But at the same time, there's a mood that by dedicating ourselves to serving his instructions, that we can feel his presence and understand what he wants. No, there's no particular Vedic rituals that we observe, but rather we gather, we talk about Srila Prabhupada and we talk about our dedication to honoring him through making his orders, our life and soul, his mission. Srila Prabhupada definitely wanted us to preach Krishna consciousness everywhere. Sometimes devotees bring articles that Prabhupada used, and we touch those articles to our head and show our, but there's no particular. We're not like the smart. We don't have a whole lot of rituals and mantras, you know, different mantras for different things. We have one mantra for everything, Hare Krishna. You know?
And also, I was thinking that those rituals have to be performed by the sons.
Uh-huh.
And like I just can't go and perform that ritual for somebody else's father.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's why we don't have, you know, like mm-hmm. the society doesn't do the ritual for them.
But then when the sannyasi, you know, when a sannyasi becomes a sannyasi, what do the sons do? Yeah.
Kesha Bharati Maharaj said his mother passed away. What did he do then?
He was showed a lot of mercy to his mother. Before she passed, she was in dementia, and so he took care of her. She didn't have anyone else to take care of her, and he read her Krishna book. And all her life she had been, you know, not happy that he had become a devotee, even maybe inimical. You know, she was a Christian, and you know, thinking this is some wrong thing. But she forgot that because she had dementia. So she started liking to hear about Krishna, and she started liking Krishna. And so she passed away peacefully after becoming a devotee. But as far as what did he do, as you know, in terms of, I'm sure that he had her cremated, and you know what we usually do. And I'm not an expert on this. I should have, when Michael was here, I was saying that I have some friends in Philadelphia. One of them is Sangeeta. She's a nurse, a hospice nurse that is special training in palliative medicine of, you know, helping ease people, make them comfortable when they die. And so she's an expert in, you know, dealing with all the things that have to be dealt with, dealing with the family and also dealing with the funeral and the cremation and then the distribution. You know, there are rituals for distributing the ashes in the Ganges, especially if people pass all here. It's very difficult to get to the Ganges, but someone will take the ashes in an urn, and then the devotees there, the pujaris, Janani Vas and his brother Pankajangri. Remember, Pankajangri came here one time, a nice brahmachari, gave class on Sunday feast. They know how to. You know, and but it's very simple. It's not, they don't make a big deal of it, but you know, it's because it's devotional. It's not a matter of, you know, karmakanda is like that. You have to do everything right, and you have to pronounce everything just right. And if you make some mistake, you don't get the result. And you know, they have special kinds of, all these different kinds of priests. You know, in the old Vedic yajnas, you know, they would have one priest would be a referee. It would make sure that the other priest was listening and making sure that they pronounced it right. And if they made a mistake, then it would be corrected, because you know it's like you know, a science project. It's like technology, you know, you have to do it all right and then you get the result, you know. And so the Vedic sacrifices are mostly like that. But devotional service is simple and sublime. It's a lot easier to do, and yet the result is a lot more wonderful. The result is that you're not trying to get anything for yourself, but you're trying to serve Krishna. But I remember I was there one time with some friend who had the ashes of their relative, and then I think that Jananivas hired a boat and took the ashes out and said some, you know, simple devotional mantras and distributed the ashes into the Ganga.
So Prabhupada, they didn't do the cremation for Prabhupada, right?
No. For great saints whose bodies are completely spiritual, then they have samadhis. They go into samadhi, and you'll see in Vrindavan and in different places there's the samadhis of different saints. And Prabhupada has a big... So his body was encased within salt and put under the earth, and the big temple was built over that in Vrindavan. So if you go...
I saw that in the video, but I didn't realize what is that white thing.
Yeah. Salt, yeah. And Hare Krishna. And so then one garland that he was wearing when he passed away, that was taken to Mayapur. And then, you know, that famous big dome building in Mayapur is Prabhupada Samadhi there. Now they're finally building the big temple of the planetarium that Prabhupada asked them to build. It will be even higher than the Samadhi dome. But first they decided to build a big Samadhi dome there. Which has been there for a long time. But, for the great acharyas, saintly people who are, you know, siddhas, they're liberated in this life, they don't have a material body, their body is considered to be completely spiritual. That's described in Nectar of Instruction too. Even if they appear old and diseased and infirm or have a bad complexion, that people accept it as completely spiritual, just like people will take bath in the Ganges, even if it's the rainy season and it's full of mud and bubbles and foam. So there were funeral observances done for Srila Prabhupada, and there was a procession that took his body around Vrindavan. I was in Vancouver. There was a... before Prabhupada passed away, he asked us all to come to Vrindavan. He said for all the devotees to come to Vrindavan, all his disciples. And somehow or another, that was a little earlier. And a number of devotees came, but not everybody came. They decided that, you know, even though Prabhupada was saying that he wouldn't really want them to. It was a little controversial, you know, that... There was a mood that Srila Prabhupada started to ask for things, like he wanted to go out and preach and go around Govardhan Hill and give lectures. And the doctors were saying that will kill him. And the devotees were not doing what he wanted, because he was pulling that kind of loving affection out of them. But it's controversial. I recently read some devotees were resenting it. That why didn't we all go like Prabhupada asked? I had given some money and I was thinking, I'm going to go. I had never been to India and I was thinking, oh, I'm going to go. Prabhupada asked us all to go. And then the temple president said that, you know, the leaders of ISKCON had decided that we shouldn't just close all the temples. And, you know, I mean, if everybody went, then, you know, how would they pay the rent and they would get evicted and what would happen to the deities and, you know, all these other kind of complications. So they decided not to all go. But many went. Every temple sent some contingent. But he didn't pass away right away. They all come there. And there was a lot of expectation that he might recover, even though the doctors were saying it's impossible, even that he was still alive, you know. But we knew that he could do anything, that he was, you know, we had absolute faith that he could do anything. And so he was telling us that. He was saying, well, if you double book distribution, I'll live another 100 years, you know. And we were thinking, Prabhupada said that, he will. You know, we really had that kind of, we had that kind of experience with Prabhupada, that what he said was so true in spite of anything seeming strange about it, that, we kind of had that faith that he wasn't really subject to the, and he wasn't subject to the laws of material nature, but yet he acted as an ordinary, even like Krishna does. You know, Krishna comes and stays for some time. He doesn't get old. There are certain things that are different about him, but at the same time, for the sake of, appearances, he sometimes pretends to lament, and when he's fighting, I think it was Shalva, was using this kind of, yaksha, mystical fighting, and a man appeared and said, this is Vasudeva, and someone looked like Krishna's father, and they cut off his head, and appeared to die. Now your father is dead, ha ha ha. And Krishna appeared to become momentarily disturbed until he realized, oh, it's just a magic trick and that wasn't really my father. But the acharyas are saying, well, why did he do that? Is it possible that Krishna could ever be bewildered by the magic of some demon? And of course not. He's not bewildered, but he plays like he's a human sometimes for some reason to make the pastime go that way.
Context of our discussion about worshipping forefathers and all, and that's 9:25 in Bhagavad Gita, which is the Yanti Deva Vrata Devan Pitrin Yanti Pitri Vrata Bhutani Yanti Bhuteya Yanti Mad Yagno Api Mam. Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me, that is Krishna, will live with me, Krishna. And I was looking through the purport, and what Prabhupada is saying here is that that's essentially what it will be, depending on who one is worshipping. They will go there. And he says that it's the pure devotee who worships the Supreme Personality of Godhead only achieves the planets of Vaikuntha and Krishna Loka without a doubt. So one of the things there is that one has to be in knowledge about this, because it says here, it is very easy to understand through this important verse that if by simply worshipping the demigods one can achieve the heavenly planets, or by worshipping the pitas achieve the pita planets, or by practicing the black arts achieve the ghostly planets, why can the pure devotee not achieve the planet of Krishna and Vishnu? Unfortunately, many people have no information of these sublime planets where Krishna and Vishnu live, and because they do not know of them, they fall down. So there are a couple of things. One is a pure devotee in knowledge is doing it, and those who are not in knowledge may not worship. That's one. And then it follows from other parts of the Bhagavad Gita that it is only necessary to worship Krishna, because by watering the root of the tree, everybody else is automatically served, right, including your forefathers and all of them.
And that ties in with before what I was saying, that if you want to actually please your forefathers, better to become a good devotee of Krishna. Yeah, the devotees of the Vaishnavas, we don't have to worship any demigods. We don't really generally, we don't worship the demigods. We don't worship the ancestors, because worshipping Krishna is sufficient.
I'm just thinking that this verse answers a lot of questions and also ties together with what Bhajan Kumar was saying, that they are those special people. So if you worship your ancestors, then you will get that kind of a body, and then you'll do those kind of tasks that you're doing. So it's not that our ancestors go and live there in the planet of ancestors. It's those who are worshipping, which would mean like the Japanese you were mentioning, who have pictures of their ancestor, they're worshipping them. Mm-hmm. They might go there.
They might end up going to become the Pita Dutas. At any rate, Krishna's relationship is not with his mothers, is not a material relationship like that, but these are all eternally liberated people. And, you know, the sages who, you know, impersonalist sages who go up, you know, and think that, well, what do I have to do with family or any personal relationships and things like that? They can't very well understand these loving relationships, these transcendental loving relationships that are all in the internal energy. They're all in the spiritual platform of pure consciousness. They don't have anything to do with actions and reactions of karma. And yet they're full of juice. They're full of rasa. They're full of emotional. But these emotions are not material emotions. Usually material emotions are under the three modes of nature. And when someone loves, you know, they had a self-help book, you know, Women Who Love Too Much. You know, when you love someone very much in the material world, it ends up usually being the source of misery and pain, because with love there is loss. And, you know, how many pop songs are about how, you know, for every single thrill, there's another heartache. You know, for every I could think of 100 pop songs that are about how that one is called "Love Is a Hurtin' Thing," sung by Lou Rawls. but this love of Krishna is a very different kind, and it's not, you know. So the impersonal one time, especially this mood of separation was exhibited by Madhavendra Puri, who we just celebrated his disappearance day, I think. And when he was passing away, he had Ishwara Puri was a very good disciple who took care of him and served him. And then he had another disciple named Ramachandra Puri who was critical of others and even criticized Lord Chaitanya later. And so when Ishwara Puri was passing away, he always worshipped Krishna in this mood of separation, and he was saying, oh, you know, he was singing out in this mood, I have not attained him, the Lord of Mathura, you know, Ai Dina Dayardra Nata Hey Mathura Nata. You know, there was one verse that the Lord Chaitanya used to recite and loved very much, that, you know, because of my not seeing him, my heart has become unsteady, what will I do, you know. So he was crying in this way, appearing like a lamentation of someone who couldn't attain his beloved. Oh, my Lord of Krishna, Lord of Mathura, where have you gone now? How I couldn't have attained you. I should be so condemned. My life has been wasted. And then Ramachandra Puri, being influenced by impersonalism, said to his spiritual master, why are you lamenting at this important time of your death? You should be meditating on Brahman. And then Madhavendra Puri was saying, oh, I was so sinful, I couldn't attain you, Lord. And now this rascal has come to tell me at the time of my death that I have to meditate on Brahman. So, I'm sorry, I don't know where. Well, I was just talking about how these emotional pastimes of Krishna and how he's meeting his mothers and he's, you know, exchanging this great affection. It's completely uncontaminated with material affection. Of course, it's good that people should be affectionate to their parents and everything. But over-affection for material things is a source of pain when there becomes separation. Similarly, in spiritual, there's the mood of separation in spiritual life is even, but that's even more an intense spiritual, you know, intense yoga, more intense form of meditation and absorption of one's senses and mind in spiritual energy. But in material life, you know, dukkha yonaya evate, and you become very, you fall in love and you become very fond of some person, and you can't live without them, and sure enough, you eventually have to live without them, or something about it turns sour. And it's the thing of most literature, you know, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, you know, that's, And then he finds her again. You know, that's the typical trajectory of the novel, you know, or something like that, that because one has attachment for something. This is the mode of passion. You develop attachment for something, and then sooner or later, you know, because material nature being what it is, being constantly in turmoil, sooner or later something comes to spoil your idyllic, you know, beautiful love story. Someone has to interfere. You know, the girl's father wants her to marry a wealthy man instead and arranges some other marriage, and she doesn't get to marry the boy she's in love with. There has to be conflict, you know, to make a drama dramatic. But actually in material life there is conflict. In material life, vipada jivera kalyana jivana anitya jana hasar tahainana vida vipada bhar. So we were reading that this morning. You know, material life is full of conflict and obstacle. That's one way. Somehow or another we fall in. Yeah. But also in the spiritual world, it's amazing that how is it that, you know, Krishna had to be separated from the gopis this essential archetype of any beautiful drama is actually there, played out in the actual pastimes of Krishna, but free from any inebriety, free from any influence of the modes of nature. And all the things that make literature attractive in the material world are because they're imitations of that, you know. But that's there in a form. Everything we see here, you know, the fact that someone is separated from their beloved, we see it here because it's actually part of the experience of real love, which is love of God. You know, love of boy meets girl, and that kind of love on the, you know, which is connected to the mating and procreative activity of, you know, human beings and everything like that. It's a very low, biological function almost to get us involved in these things. But the people who tell mundane stories and sing mundane songs and watch the cinema, love movies and things like that, they have a taste for those kind of things. But but that's because it's a reflection of the actual truth of real love, which is in the absolute platform. It actually goes on and it really exists. And the Mayavadis are wrong when they think the absolute truth is only, you know, like plain vanilla, one color, one without any variety, without any emotion, because it's steady, you know, Brahmavid, Brahmana. We were saying the other day, Naprakrishet Priyang Prapya Nodvijet Prapya Chapriyam. Vaish was saying on the Nisringa Chaturdasi, how, you know, to be on the spiritual platform, one has that samatvam, that steadiness and equipoise. One sees everything. One sees Brahman everywhere, which was displayed by Prahlad Maharaj, that one is not disturbed by the vicissitudes of material nature. But beyond that, there are varieties in devotional service, which is full of juicy, tasty spiritual emotions, which are actually the prototypes, the real substance of which the material relationships are a reflection. That in the 15th chapter of the Gita, Krishna describes the upside down banyan tree. Oh, is it 10:30 already? Yikes! We should get on to Guru Puja, but you know, there's an upside down banyan tree with its roots up and its branches down, and its leaves are the Vedic hymns, and its twigs are the, you know, the objects of the senses and so forth. And then Srila Prabhupada describes in the purport that where do we see an upside-down tree? It's when it's a reflection of a real tree, you know, and in the water. So this material world is like a reflection in the water of desire. It's a reflection of what's really going on elsewhere in the spiritual world, that there's a real emotional relationships in these different primary rasas, as neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parental affection, which is being displayed here, and conjugal love, and then the seven minor rasas, you know, chivalry, ghastliness, what are they, humor, you know, laughing, fear, surprise, you know, there's the different, and then they mix, you know, so this is all explained in the Nectar of Devotion, how they mix, and they mix nicely, or they maybe mix not quite correctly, and the, you know, as the devotee becomes a connoisseur, they can experience it exactly, you know, beautiful ecstasy, correctly, and prema. All right, let's, unless anyone has any final comment, or we can start Guru Puja.
I think you somehow answer that. My question was, even it is in a material world, it can be attraction or affection, but the true meaning of love is a transcendental quality, right?
It's a transcendental quality.
Yes. Whether it is boy to man, the girl, or mother to son, or even if it is anything else.
Right? True love is for Krishna. Really. They say that a mother's love for a child in the material world is something like that, because we see, Prabhupada says, it's the strongest, because we see that a mother will sacrifice herself for her child. So it's very, very strong. That it's, but all material relationships are, you know, based on the platform of selfishness to a certain extent. It's kama. Krishnadas Kaviraj says, you know, that iron and gold, they're both metals, but they have very different qualities. You know, iron is black and, you know, it has this very coarse, rough quality, and then gold is very shiny and bright and beautiful. So material love is compared to iron, and love of Krishna is compared to gold. It's really a different substance altogether. It just appears the same way. And that doesn't mean that we're, you know, some people would say, oh, you Hare Krishnas, you're denigrating love. Love is the highest thing. People should love and stuff like that. No, not really. We're not. We're saying there's a purer love. And when you have that, like we were talking about before, if you water the root of the tree, when you have that, you can naturally, the quality of a devotee who loves Krishna is so nice, they don't envy any other living being. So that, like the six Goswamis were said that they were beloved by both the dhira and the adhira, that, you know, by the well-behaved people and by the ruffians, that they were the gentle people and the ruffians, because a saintly person that has all these wonderful qualities, when they love Krishna, then automatically they don't have any enemies. They do everything very nicely, and they're not. Selfish or proud, so everybody can easily relate to them, and that's real love. So, yeah, some people would think, oh, how are you denigrating? You say that there's no friendship and there's no love in the world, but really, without Krishna consciousness, that all the friendship and love and heroism and, you know, valor, you know, and all the things that people value very much, are just a very poor imitation of spiritual qualities. So therefore, the Srimad Bhagavatam says that those who listen to story, those who like, you know, literature that's full of descriptions of people who aren't devotees, it compares them to hogs, dogs, camels, and asses, that they're praising other people who aren't devotees of Krishna, you know, and they get all excited, oh, this person is such a great hero and has such great qualities and stuff. And Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadev Goswami is saying, you know, they're just like animals, like farm animals, they're wasting their time, you know, and that all the famous greatest heroes and the people, political leaders and people of great esteem that ever, you know, that you're supposed to really admire them, or else you're a bad person, you know. From the standard of someone like Shukadev Goswami, they're not that important, you know. That a real saint is something very rare and unusual, and that they're always chanting about Krishna. And you could see that in the life of Srila Prabhupada, how he was constantly talking about Krishna, constantly absorbed in Krishna, and was moved by ecstasy, even though he didn't display often his ecstatic emotions. Sometimes tears would shoot from his eyes, and he would lose his external consciousness in love of Krishna and stuff. And he was always dedicated to fulfilling the orders of his spiritual master to glorify Krishna everywhere. So that's the real standard of love. And that all the other loves, love of your country, love of your, you know, mathematics or some academic department, you know, or someone to, you know, or love of the family or love of the, you know. Because if you love your family, it really means you're competing with somebody else's family, isn't it? I want all the best for my family, so I get a better deal. You know, in the marketplace, I have to get a better deal and not pay too much for the, you know, like Jagarini and I just went and bought a washer and dryer and a mattress, and we're thinking we want to get the best deal. And then we're not getting as good of a commission for the salesman, you know, whatever. You know, it's always like that. Jay.
Does not reject family life,
no,
and all these association, all these relationships. And it would assume that in this discussion, the key thing is that people have to see that they don't get attached to these mm-hmm. things in a primary way.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is said is our attachment should be to Krishna and detachment to these other things. There is no problem in having the associations.
Mm-hmm.
Have them and even get them into Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
But don't be attached to it,
right,
which is also the message of the Gita. The attachment should be towards Krishna, whereas
right,
you say the real love is. So,
if you're really a devotee, then your kids will see how you enjoy chanting and they'll follow and imitate and they'll become devotees and you'll be doing the best for them. It's like, what do they say? The carrots are good for the eyes, you know, but you have to eat the carrots. If you put the carrots in your eyes, it won't be good. So people may feel like their love and affection for their kids, but they express that love and affection in the wrong way, like my wife's mother, oh, you get that Krishna stuff around me, or whatever. She's not doing the best thing for her daughter. But if she were a great devotee, then naturally it would be the best, On that platform, when we become free from envy, illusion, anger, you know, madness, and you know, these things, then we can actually exchange nice relationships. We can have good, healthy relationships on the platform of really understanding we're spirit souls and not having these needs that we have to fulfill based on our conditioning that we, you know, that is unhealthy relationships with people. Yeah. Equivision says, yeah. Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmane Gavihastini. Vaish was also, he was at the same time in the Nisringa Chaturdasi, he was talking about that equipoise means that you can actually offer proper respect to all living entities by seeing how their spirit soul and their every spirit soul is connected to Krishna. He's never super soul comes with them. He never is separated even for a minute from any living being. Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.